So to begin with, first thing I really wanted to say some brief comments on, well, what do we mean by norms? Because obviously this is going to be a key concept that we're bandying about today, and I think it still merits a little bit of a fuller consideration and reflection before we begin, if only because it is really quite ubiquitous. I have good Oxford roots in this, as I came on my train journey back from Paddington Station to Oxford. In a way, it is coming home because I began my academic career here in 1992, and I was working with William Wallace, with Adam Roberts, and I had dear old James Mayle as my examiner. And all of this is telling me lots and lots, probably, about my approach to norms, which is that they begin very much from a quintessential English school tradition, which takes norms for granted. Because quite obviously we have norms. We know that we have norms. This is the basis for social organization and intercourse. And we see this in every form of human society that you could care to point to. We have norms right here in the room with us. We are all conforming to norms, that is, behavioral expectations, about what it means to give a competent intellectual paper and how we behave behind the podium and what is polite to do in academic circles and what isn't. And obviously,
you're just a bit too near.
You see, I'm not conforming. This is terrible.
Not conforming.
So when we think of a norm, we're thinking about rules of human conduct. We're trying to understand how it is that human beings can come together in an organization, how that organization can sustain itself, and ultimately, of course, how it deals with difficulties in human interaction, because that's what the norm is intended to do, to ease our social interaction by making certain forms of behavior obligatory and others, of course, off limits. That is the essence of a norm. When we think about where norms come from, again, this is a bit of a curiosity because back in 1992, I began very much thinking about where a norm came from, but not in the language of today, because my original PhD dissertation was exploring the ways in which international discourse on national minorities had, at this point in time, rather suddenly reappeared after having disappeared for half a century. And at that point in time, this, to some people, could seem like a rather close subject. And I was told by William Wallace to delve deeply into the bowels of the Bodleian Library, which I did quite literally, in the underfloor caverns of the Radcliffe Camera, where the International Document Depository may still be found. And I went pulling open these revolving shelves designed centuries past to find the last reference in the Council of Europe and other places in international organization to national minorities and their rights. And when I came across them, I felt a bit like an explorer coming across a city lost deep in a jungle where nobody had trod for years and years because the dust was thick on these documents. And I opened them up, and out fell a yellowed with time, crumbling into disintegration bit of paper, which in the BOD is actually the last person to have signed this thing out, and it invariably went back to about 1950. At which point, modern inclination having to do with human rights was taking off, and the discourse on national minorities more or less disappeared. So in a sense, it was the beginning of norm entrepreneurship of national minority rights in Europe, but nobody phrased it that way. Which gets me to the second bit of my paper, which is this idea of where do norms come from? And I've had a bit of fun with the subtitle. I have a six-year-old, and any parent will tell you, you reach a point where you get these awkward questions about babies, and you try and provide kind of vague and not very detailed responses. And in English, we have this euphemism about the birds and the bees as an answer to these sorts of questions. And in social sciences, we have a similar kind of a naturalist metaphor to try and come up with an explanation for where norms come from. We obviously know they come from somewhere. We know they change. We know behavior changes, we know norms change, we know there's got to be some kind of a causal relationship between the two of them, but for rather a long time, we just all more or less took for granted, and you didn't fully introspectively try and come up with causal explanation. So now we have moved beyond this state of lack of explanatory depth, and we now have, of course, the language of the life cycle of a norm. Again, picking up metaphors in the way of birds and bees, so that we have an understanding that a norm comes into discourse through the innovative actions of an actor. We tend to refer to, it's already been mentioned by Jeffrey, as a norm entrepreneur. It is the wonderful responsibility of the norm entrepreneur to vocalize the new norm, to try and popularize it, to try and convince the norm leaders to adopt it as persuasive and authoritative. And then once that happens, we have a further metaphor drawn from nature of cascade. The norm cascades down from the norm leaders through society, and it gathers momentum, and at some point, which is always hard to identify, it reaches a tipping point at which, says the life cycle of the norm, we are moving rapidly towards the end of the life cycle, which curiously is not the death of the norm, but actually the internalization of the norm to the point where we are no longer even aware of it, simply because it is so deeply internalized. So we take it all for granted. Of course, while this process is happening, death often actually does occur, because very often, frequently, the rise of one norm actually can involve the death, more or less, of another one. And you can have these alter egos, and we see them in many places, and if you want to point to national minority rights, it has as its alter ego, of course, a kind of assimilationist discourse. And these two ebb and flow really in contrast to one another. And in 1992, assimilation was ebbing, national minority rights were rising. I'm a bit of a skeptic. Around about 2012, it seemed to be moving in the opposite direction a little more. And certainly, I don't think anyone plausibly would suggest we've reached norm internalization with regard to minority discourses. Not yet. Where does all of this leave us in terms of trying to understand the Council of Europe or any other putative points of entry for new norms? Well, this is the bit where I depart from my paper entirely, and I'm actually going to take you back to one of my favorite classic English scholars reflecting on ideas of social change. Anyone remember dear old Robin Nisbet? Around about 1972, he wrote a very interesting article looking at nature metaphors and their use in the social sciences. And actually what he was wanting to reflect on was the way in which social scientists borrow languages from the natural scientists, principally to try and understand change. And of course, the borrowing of the life cycle metaphor, and it is a metaphor, in fact, the language of norm entrepreneurs, also another metaphor, borrowed in this sense from the commercial sphere. We borrow these metaphors and we use them because they seem to capture in similitude some of the processes that we are interested in thinking about further. There is always a catch with metaphor, however, and that is that inevitably there is a difference between the point of the metaphor, where it comes from, what it refers back to, and what we're actually interested in. In this sense, the Popperian distinction between the natural world and the social world. So the life cycle of the norm, while useful, has inbuilt within it quite a few caveats, and some of them have already been touched on by Jeffrey and others in their different presentations, but perhaps one would find it useful to just point them all out in a block at this juncture. First of all, of course, there is this idea inbuilt in the notion of a life cycle that we have a clear ontological beginning and a clear end. Actually, of course, we don't. Social life is rather more complex than that. And if you look at any particular norm, and I give you a few examples very briefly in what I've passed around, in fact, there are potentially multiple entry points that you could look at if you were wanting to policy trace, so that there are many, many policy paths. And instead, what you see, really, when a norm gains cascade, is that these multiple points of entry are actually mutually reinforcing one another. A historical example, but it fits the bill beautifully, relates to some bedside reading I've recently done. A woman by the name of Eglantine Jebb. Anyone ever heard of Eglantine Jebb? Fascinating biography published by an obscure Oxford press recently. She was, in fact, one of the founders of the Save the Children Fund, a British social reformer. And in 1923, she goes to Geneva to a beginning meeting of the naissant NGO Save the Children, and she suggests that children ought to have rights. And further, that it would be really quite helpful if there was an international declaration on children's rights. And this is the moment where the League is just formed, and we have the League Covenant, and we have an interest, of course, in the organization of international society and the rebuilding of that in post-First World War era to preserve peace for posterity. And so Jed sits down, and she writes a document, and it gets the approval of the Save the Children Fund. And a few years later, it actually gets the further approval of the League of Nations. And there are NGO meetings around this. And really, this looks to be a very interesting example of norm entrepreneur, Eglantine, and norm leaders being convinced by what she's saying in the form of the members of the League of Nations and the Council of the League of Nations. And we do see evidence of cascade. And then it all goes pear-shaped, as the league system generally does, because we have the depression and we have the move towards a return to war, and all of this disappears, and poor old Eglantine actually passes away rather prematurely, and it seems to have completely withered on the vine. But lo and behold, in 1948, we have a new discourse on human rights, and we have a new international organization called the United Nations, and they turn back to JEB and her original document, and they rewrite a new declaratory statement on the rights of the children in 1959. And in 1989, we actually have an internationally binding covenant, a text, on the rights of the child. An awful lot of it, if you go back and read JEB's original document, match in very interesting ways. So policy tracing could have loads of fun. If anyone is a PhD student out there looking for an interesting thesis, I would suggest this is a good one. So it seems to work perfectly, and it seems to fit the life cycle of a norm. But the life cycle of a norm misses all the down points. It misses the depression. It misses war. It misses the fact that this fell away. There is nothing linear about the process. It fits and starts. It goes forward. It goes backwards. There's nothing linear necessarily about who puts it forward either. As I said, multiple actors, multiple points of entry. And just as norms are born, norms can and do die. So I think when we go forward in our conversation today, it is perhaps prudent to bear in mind the limitations of metaphor and the reality that the social world is far more complex in terms of cause and effect than the natural metaphor of a simplistic life cycle, birds, bees, whatever one might think of in this context, would suggest. So that when we are thinking about norms in the Council of Europe or under other auspices, to truly begin to understand their complexity, I think it is important to maintain an awareness of this multiplicity of action and of social circumstance and of historical contingency in all of it, because really this is the true sense in which we must understand norms, because this is the reality of the social world in which we live and the sense in which it is constructed mutually by all of us with all of our limitations and therefore, of course, all of our impermeability and fluid flux. And I'll leave it there.